Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn about broccoli from the University of Illinois and how it can protect against liver cancer. And also, most people have thought that dairy is the best source of the bacteria that helps to diversify the gut with good quality microbiota. Not true. According to the latest study, it is really soy, and we'll talk about that. Urinary tract infection, oh, they're very common. How bacteria gets in there. University of Basel and what we can do to get rid of that bacteria. And from Henry Ford Hospital, asthma symptoms linked to increased stress, anxiety levels in teens. And time to rethink your vegetable oil. Ohio State University has the latest on that and a lot more. Then we're going to take a look at one of the biggest problems in America that is not getting attention. And it's interconnected. Three things. One, why the war on drugs is a huge failure. And it is a failure. It is a disaster for everyone involved. And what could we do instead of a war on drugs? Secondly, the war on poor, just being poor itself, means you're now a target of the U.S. and local governments. I'll give you one example of how bad it is. A homeless man owes the government over $110,000 in fines for being homeless. Think I'm kidding? I'm not. And then we look at the profit in private prisons and how you're poor to begin with. So society should be doing something to alleviate the underlying conditions that allow that poverty. Instead, it exploits you being poor, exploits people having to get a payday loan and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars over a period of a lifetime, just constantly rebooting those loans, paying more and more interest. It can be excessive, certainly upwards of 500 to 1,000% interest. All you're doing is paying interest. But if you don't pay it, you can be arrested. Yeah, people are being arrested all over America and put into private jails. I'll explain the whole lockdown on American workforce, some outstanding work by Steve Frazier and Joshua Freeman on Tom's Dispatch on that. I'm going to be sharing a lot of commentaries this week, commentaries I've written and commentaries other people have written I'll be commenting on, including Chris Hedges's The Graveyard of the Elites from Truthdig, and also something that you just do not hear anywhere in the American media. And I commend Mr. Hagopian for writing this for Global Research. It's called It's Time to Stop Supporting Our Troops. 30 million people killed by U.S. since the end of World War II. Well, I support troops that need help. I oppose their wars. But you'll see what he's talking about when I share that commentary. We have some powerful commentaries this week. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. We always begin on something we can all agree upon. Let's live a longer and healthier life. And to do that, we have to make sure that the choices we're making each day provide that. Otherwise, we live in this kind of cognitive disconnect. We want to be healthy, yet our choices are not healthy. We want to be happy, and yet our choices frequently lead to unhappiness. We keep doubling down on the wrong emotions, the wrong attitude, and then wonder, gee whiz, why does that door keep closing? Well, have you ever thought what it's like to be on the other side of a bad temper, a bad attitude, a manipulative nature? So think about what you do, because there will be a consequence to every single action in life. It may not seem important in that moment, but it's cumulative, and sooner or later, it all comes out. This is about broccoli. Most Americans don't eat broccoli. They just don't like the taste of it from what the studies show. But you can disguise the taste of broccoli. Broccoli is very easy to prepare. You can take some a wok, a simple a basket, bamboo basket, and you put that over some boiling water, and as the vapors, the water, come up through the wok basket, it steams the broccoli for about 5 minutes, so it's no longer hard. But it's still completely nutritious. Actually, it's more nutritious because you've made the nutrients more bioavailable by breaking down the hard outside lignocellulose, the fibrous material, because it's inside that fibrous material that all the good healing nutrients are, including indole-3-carbinol and isothiocyanates, which are anti-cancer, immune-stimulating nutrients. This is from the University of Illinois. Quote, consumption of broccoli has increased in the United States over the last few decades, as scientists have reported that eating the vegetable 3 to 5 times a week can lower the risk of many types of cancer, including breast, prostate, and colon cancers. A new study from the University of Illinois reports that including broccoli in the diet may also protect against liver cancer, as well as aid in the countering of development of fatty liver and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which can cause malfunction of the liver and lead to hepatocellular carcinoma, a liver cancer with high death rate. Quote, the normal story about broccoli and health is that it can protect against a number of different cancers, but nobody had looked at liver cancer. We decided that liver cancer needed to be studied, particularly because of the obesity epidemic in the United States. It is already in the literature that obese people have a higher risk of liver cancer, and this is particularly true of men. They have almost a 500% greater risk of liver cancer if they are obese. So then they took a look at this study and found out, gee whiz, having broccoli does protect your liver. So that's very important. So I suggest that you have broccoli 4 days a week. Now, another good way to have broccoli is the crowns. You steam them, then blanch them, which means you run cold water over them. Then you put them in the fridge and then throw them into a salad. That's an easy way. Or you can use them as crudités. You can make a nice dip, maybe a tahini dip made out of sesame paste, or maybe a tofu mustard dip, or maybe a vinaigrette, olive oil, little sea salt, Himalayan sea salt, pink sea salt. And just dip it in and have it. In fact, one of the ways that we would lose a lot of weight and be a lot healthier is if for a month we didn't sit down to a regular meal 3 times a day. Instead, we grazed. Grazing is when you start your day with a protein shake. And in that protein shake, a smoothie, you have a plant-based protein, hemp, brown rice, any of these soy, non-genetically engineered soy, these are all good. Brown rice and split pea are particularly good, as is hemp. Throw in some berries, that's your polyphenols, and then put in some vegetable powder and have an almond milk, a coconut milk, and a scoop of teaspoon of coconut oil and a teaspoon of flaxseed oil and a handful of nuts, your favorite raw nut. Blend that up, and that's good for 5 hours. Then in the afternoon, have yourself maybe a salad. Then later, when you feel a little hungry, have an apple. Have some broccoli, asparagus. Have yourself some cruciferous vegetables that you've blanched, and then dip into a sauce for some seasoning. And that's grazing, where you're, instead of eating one large meal, you're eating smaller amounts of food that supply the body with nutrients and energy, and don't overwhelm the digestive system. So in this study, it was shown from DuPont Nutrition and Health that soy protein, and we're talking about organic, non-GMO soy, may diversify gut microbiota more than dairy protein. Quote, protein from soy may contribute to a more diverse microbiota than protein from milk sources, say a new study from DuPont Nutrition and Health that links changes in your gut to soy protein lipid-lowering properties, meaning you lower your cholesterol, you lower your triglycerides, you lower many of the fats you don't want elevated when you have soy protein. That was published in the Journal of Nutrition. from University of Basel in Switzerland, almost every second woman suffers from a bladder infection at some point in her life. Also, men are affected by cystitis, though less frequently. In 80% of the cases, it is caused by an intestinal bacterium, E. coli. It travels along the urethra to the bladder, where it triggers painful infections. This according to the peer-reviewed journal Nature and Communications. Universities from a research in the University of Basel explain how this bacterium attaches to the surface of the urinary tract via a protein with a sophisticated locking technique, which prevents it from being flushed out by the urine flow. So what to do about it? Well, what they don't say in here is two things that are very easy to do. How does a bacteria from your gut, from your intestine, get into your urethra? Because we are not hygienic. We will wipe after defecation. We will not wash. Real hygiene means that you take soap and water and you properly cleanse your anus and dry it, and that prevents the millions of bacteria that are there. If you just wipe, then the normal heat of the body, the friction of moving, will cause bacteria to travel. And they travel down, and they travel to a point like the urethra. They go in and set up shop in the bladder. Now, let's say that we understand proper hygiene, and we apply that. That would be great. In Europe, it's very common. They have bidets. You sit on a toilet. When you finish the toilet, then you sit on a bidet right beside it. It looks like a toilet, and it cleanses you. That's a good thing. In Japan, they actually have a bidet-toilet combination. It's very common. They're very much into good hygiene, much better hygiene in Japan than we are as a society. And also, the restaurants are much cleaner. How they handle food and washing food and washing their hands, washing surface areas, much cleaner. Having owned 3 gourmet vegan restaurants and being a chef, I can assure you that even with proper instruction and diligence, you'll still see people who do not practice proper hygiene. So hygiene's number one, but let's say that you have someone who's maybe not going to practice the hygiene they should. What to do then? You can cause that bacteria to be disconnected from that docking mechanism they just discussed, adhering to the cell surface, by using cranberry, pomegranate concentrates, wild oregano oil, and vitamin C. A combination of those together in a drink and grapefruit juice will dislodge the bacteria. And that's why anyone that I've counseled who has urinary tract infections, by altering their diet, giving them that simple combination in 1 or 2 days, it cleanses the bladder, dislodges the bacteria, and they don't have to worry about having rounds of antibiotics. Something simple, not complicated. Asthma used to be very rare in our society. Today, it's epidemic. According to a Henry Ford Hospital study, they found that common asthma symptoms like waking up in the middle of the night and shortness of breath are associated with an increased levels of stress and anxiety in teens. And that's understandable, because think of how many teens today, over one half, 50%, live near the poverty level. Think of the anxiety of not knowing when you go home, will you have a home to go to? Think of what happens when there is financial privations, where you're having to constantly be aware that your family is not able to afford things, including many times just the basics. 1.6 million children leave school each day and have no home to return to. I filmed in Poverty Inc., though I didn't put it in the final film. I still have 100 hours a film that over the next couple of years I'll be presenting up on the internet from that really massive, almost 7 years of filming. Let me give you an example. A woman who was once married to, of all things, a banker, and lived a upper middle class, comfortable life, wanted for nothing, two teenage daughters who participated in everything that teenagers generally participate in, and then they got divorced. Then the husband lost his job and could not afford the child support. The wife had to go out and learn some new skills. She did homesitting. She did house cleaning. That was not enough to maintain the standard of living. Instead of changing the standard of living, this is where it gets interesting. When she had discussions with her daughters about what she could no longer afford, they were angry at her. And they took it personally that because they couldn't go to the malls and spend the money on things they didn't need, that it was her fault. They couldn't have all the classes that had been private classes that they had paid for in the past. Instead of looking at helping the mother, they were angry with her. That caused her to become depressed. She overate. She became obese. And that caused health problems. And all the while, she's working 12-hour days, 6 days a week, in order to keep the house. She should have given the house up. The payments were way too expensive. When they finally did give it all up, she was deep in debt. She had no savings and had to finally go live in the attic of her parents' elderly parents' home. And that wasn't good because the mother was suffering from memory loss. The father was agitated. He was in his 70s. She was around in her mid-40s with these two daughters who seemed to have been disconnected from the reality of what was happening because they had been protected. Now they were literally, at one point after leaving there, homeless. So the mother had spoken with a friend of hers and came up with a rather ingenious idea. She put whatever assets she did have into a large van. And in this van, her friend put in some of the just the basic, like a refrigerator that would work off, a little refrigerator that would work off the car engine and electrical system, and little fold-down cots that the three of them could at least sleep in it, and a carbon monoxide detection device in case there was carbon monoxide buildup, which, by the way, can happen in cars, and a place, a rack to put their clothing. And in other words, in this van, she realized she didn't know how long she would be homeless, but at least she wanted some care. And she said each day she would drop her kids off two blocks from school so none of their friends saw. After school, or after activities after school, she would pick them up, and then they would go to a place and you know, eat. Do you realize how common that is? We're not talking about one family. We're talking about millions, tens of millions of people who are poor, struggling, and 32 million homeless. Why don't we see those numbers anywhere? Because they only count the people who are registered in places like a shelter. That's a tiny percentage. They don't count all the people sleeping in their cars, couch surfing in friends and family's basements and rec rooms and attics, or you know, put together garages, which I've seen. In one street down in Florida, on a Saturday, when I was driving down the street, I just noticed how many cars were parked in these little 12 to 1,500 square foot houses. This was a working class neighborhood. I was curious, so I pulled over and I said, it's not a Sunday, so it's not the ball games, people coming over. It's a Saturday. Why out of this whole block of maybe 50 homes, why do like 80% of them have all these cars? And the guy said, are you from the city? I said, no. He's, you from the state? I said, no, I'm just a person interested. He said, well, he said, here, I'm working on changing my garage into a living space for my brother and his family. And I've got to put a toilet in there. I've got to, you know, put a carpet on the floor. We've got to try to make it habitable. It doesn't even have heat or air in there. And it's more the air we're going to put. and the city won't give us a permit to do this because this is a single family occupant house. They're very strict about this. And so people can only do it on Saturdays when, you know, there's no one inspecting. He said, all these people on this whole area here, this is just one block. He said, these are all family members who've lost their homes. So underneath the radar, tens of millions of Americans have lost their homes, and they're staying in these temporary quarters in cars and RVs, and they don't count. Nobody counts them. They're invisible, and that's unfortunate because what we're not willing to look at and examine, we cannot change. Now imagine being a teenager. Now imagine being stressed. Now imagine asthma. And then you see why we have so many. That's one of the reasons. Vaccinations are another thing that causes asthma. But in the American diet, that causes asthma. Just that. And finally, from Ohio State University, the risk of heart disease and diabetes can be lowered by a diet in good lipids. Lipids are fats. And they looked at grape seed. Now, grape seed oil comes from grapes. And we know how healthy olive oil is, but I've said for a long time that tomato oil made from tomato seeds and grape seeds are one of nature's most perfect items. Perfect. If you look at the grape and you look at the skin, the seed, there's 90% of your healing benefit. The flesh inside is okay, but it's the skin and the seed where you get your benefit. So if you're able to make an oil from grape seeds, it's going to be higher in linoleic acid, L-I-N-O, leic, L-E-I-C. That lowers insulin resistance, which is a precursor to diabetes. That helps prevent heart disease and diabetes. And that could be very important. Now, you can buy grape seed oil. It's expensive because there's not many people making it. But if you want something really good for your heart, something that's really healthy in the long chain, omega-3 fatty acids, then that is just something new. It also is anti-inflammatory. And anything that turns off inflammation is good. And the higher levels of oleic, O-L-E-I-C acid, or the long chain omega-3, this is also good for your heart. So that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. From all the stations around the United States who are playing this program, thank you for doing that and for bringing the information that we share to the people in your audience. It's much appreciated, including the hippest, most progressive radio station in Woodstock that carries us every day. Sure do appreciate it. I get a lot of mail and email from the people up there in Woodstock. Great community. Now we're going to take a look at an issue that I believe should be front and center because of its impact. That is the war on drugs. When you consider that just in Mexico, the latest figures are 150,000 dead, over 80,000 missing. When you look at South America, Central America, when you look at the impact of the war on drugs in creating gangs, cartels, weaponizing, the terror of the citizens, when you look at the health consequences of a society, everything that you could do wrong, we've done wrong. And yet it's taken us 40 years even to be able to look at the mistakes we've made. Let me share some reasons why the war on drugs is a huge failure.
Over 40 years ago, U.S. President Richard Nixon declared drug abuse public enemy number one, starting an unprecedented global campaign, the War on Drugs. Today, the numbers are in. The War on Drugs is a huge failure with devastating unintended consequences. It led to mass incarceration in the U.S., to corruption, political destabilization and violence in Latin America, Asia and Africa, to systemic human rights abuses across the world. It negatively affected the lives of millions of people. All of this while we waste billions of dollars every year only to create and fuel powerful drug cartels, while the goal of the War on Drugs seems less achievable than ever, a world without drugs. How could this happen? The core strategy of the War on Drugs is no drugs, no problems. So almost all of the efforts in the last few decades have been focused on eradicating the supply of drugs and incarcerating drug traffickers. But this ignores the most fundamental of market forces, supply and demand. If you reduce the supply of anything without reducing the demand first, its price goes up. This might lower sales for many products, but not for drugs. The drugs market is not price sensitive. Drugs will be consumed no matter what they cost. So the effect is to encourage production of more drugs and recruitment of more traffickers, which increases availability. This is also known as the balloon effect. Even if drug production or a major supply route is destroyed, the supply for the end user is not reduced. A perfect example of this is crystal meth. The US government tried to stop its production by strictly regulating the sale of chemicals used to manufacture the drug. This forced big meth producers out of business, but the unintended consequences were that thousands of small-scale operations started all over the country, mostly in small towns and rural communities, using chemicals that weren't regulated. In response to this, some U.S. states wanted to reduce the supply of homegrown meth by regulating even more chemicals, which reduced small-scale meth production drastically. But the supply of meth still stayed the same. Mexican drug cartels immediately took over and opened big production operations. Their meth was even better than it was before, and they had loads of experience in smuggling. So all these efforts made meth production more professional, the drug more potent, while supply wasn't reduced at all. You can't win this war on the supply side. Not only are drugs widely available, demand unbroken, and some drugs purer than in the past, with a budget of around $30 billion, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency has an efficiency rate of less than 1% when it comes to stopping the flow of drugs into the U.S. and inside the U.S. For many minors around the world, it's as easy to get illegal drugs as alcohol. But it doesn't stop here. Prohibition may prevent a certain amount of people from taking drugs, but in the process, it causes huge damage to society as a whole. Many of the problems we associate with drug use are actually caused by the war against them. For example, prohibition makes drugs stronger. The more potent drugs you can store in as little space as possible, the more profit you'll make. It was the same during alcohol prohibition, which led to an increased consumption of strong liquor over beer. The prohibition of drugs also led to more violence and murders around the world. Gangs and cartels have no access to the legal system to settle disputes, so they use violence. This led to an ever-increasing spiral of brutality. According to some estimates, the homicide rate in the U.S. is 25 to 75% higher because of the war on drugs. And in Mexico, a country on the front line, an estimated 164,000 have been murdered between 2007 and 2014. More people than in the war zones of Afghanistan and Iraq in the same period combined. But where the war on drugs might do the most damage to society is the incarceration of non-violent drug offenders. For example, the United States, one of the driving forces of the war on drugs, has 5% of the world's total population, but 25% of the world's prison population, largely due to the harsh punishments and mandatory minimums. Minorities suffer because of this especially. African Americans make up 40% of all U.S. prison inmates. And while white kids are more likely to abuse drugs, black kids are 10 times more likely to get arrested for drug offenses. Okay, but is there actually something different we could do? Is there a way out of this mess? In the 1980s, Switzerland experienced a public health crisis related to heroin use. HIV rates skyrocketed and street crime became a problem. Swiss authorities tried a new strategy, harm reduction. they opened free heroin maintenance centers where addicts would be treated and stabilized. Here, people would be given free heroin of high quality, they would get clean needles, and have access to safe injection rooms, showers, beds, and medical supervision. Social workers helped them find housing and deal with other problems in their lives. The results were a sharp drop in drug-related crime, and two-thirds of the people in the centers got regular jobs because now they could focus on getting better instead of financing their addiction. Today, over 70% of all heroin addicts in Switzerland receive treatment. HIV infections have dropped drastically. Deaths from heroin overdoses have dropped by 50%. And drug-related street sex work and crime has been reduced enormously. So there are methods that are not only way cheaper, but also actually work instead of creating more problems. Drug prohibition led to a system that bulldozes human rights, costs vast sums of money, and creates a lot of human misery, all in pursuit of an unobtainable goal. After 40 years of fighting, it's time to finally end the war on drugs and move on to something better. This video was supported by the Open Society Foundations and by viewer donations on Patreon. If you want to learn more about how you can influence drug policy, check out the Stop the Harm campaign.
I'd like to share a little different perspective now than what you're used to hearing. This is from Steve Frazier and Joshua Friedman of Tom Dispatch. It's called Locking Down an American Workforce. I'll quote it. Then I'm going to have you call in on both the war on drugs, what you believe, what you personally believe would be a good way of approaching it, as well as the fact that two things are frequently associated. You don't focus upon what causes the drug addiction, which would be reasonable. Instead, society focuses upon punishing people for using drugs, but take no responsibility for the conditions under which people are living that may have precipitated that need. Then you put them into a private prison system with further profits the corporations that have privatized the prison system. Quote, sweatshop labor is back with a vengeance. It can be found across broad stretches of the American economy and around the world. Penitentiaries have become a niche market for such work. The privatization of prisons in recent years has meant the creation of a small army of workers too coerced and rightless to complain. Prisoners, whose ranks increasingly consist of those for whom the legitimate economy has found no use, now make up a virtual brigade within the reserve army of the unemployed, whose ranks have ballooned along with U.S. incarceration rate. The Corrections Corporation of America and G4S, formerly Wackenhut, two private prison systems, sell inmate labor at sub-minimal wages to Fortune 500 corporations like Chevron, Bank of America, AT&T, IBM, and Whole Foods. These companies can, Whole Foods is, I know, that's my own statement. These companies can, in most states, lease factories in prisons or prisoners to work on the outside. All told, nearly a million prisoners are now making office furniture, working in call centers, fabricating body armor, taking hotel reservations, working in slaughterhouses, or manufacturing textiles and shoes and clothing while getting paid somewhere between 93 cents and $4.73 a day. Rarely can you find workers so pliable, easy to control, stripped of political rights, and subject to martial discipline at the first sign of any unusual occurrence. Unless, that is, you travel back into the 19th century when convict labor was commonplace nationwide. Indeed, a sentence of confinement at hard labor was then the essence of the American penal system. More than that, it was one vital way the United States became a modern industrial capitalist economy, at a moment eerily like our own, when the mechanisms of capital accumulation were in crisis. What some historians call the Long Depression of the 19th century, which lasted from the mid-1870s through the mid-1890s, was marked by frequent panics and slumps, mass bankruptcies, deflation, and self-destructive competition among businesses designed to depress cost, especially labor cost. So, too, we are living through a 21st century age of panics and austerity with similar pressures to shrink the social wage. Convict labor has been, and once again, is an appealing way for business to address these dilemmas. Penal servitude now strikes us as a barbaric throwback to some long-lost moment that preceded the Industrial Revolution. But in that, we are wrong. From its first appearance in this country, it has been associated with modern capitalist industry and large-scale agriculture. And that is only the first of many misconceptions about this peculiar institution. Infamous for the brutality with which prison laborers were once treated, indelibly linked in popular memory and popular culture with images of the black chain gang of the American South. It is usually assumed to be a Southern invention. So apparently, it seems to fit naturally with the retrograde nature of Southern life and labor, its economic and culture under development, its racial caste system, and its desperate attachment to the lost cause. As it happens, penal servitude, the leasing out of prisoners to private enterprise, either within prison walls or in outside workshops, factories, and fields, was originally known as a Yankee invention. First used at Auburn Prison in New York State in the 1820s, the system spread widely and quickly throughout the North, the Midwest, and later the West. It developed alongside state-run prison workshops that produced goods for the public sector and sometimes the open market. A few Southern states also used it. Prisoners there, as elsewhere, however, were mainly white men, since slave masters, with a free hand to deal with the infractions of their chattel, had a little need for prison. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery would, in fact, make an exception for penal servitude precisely because it had become the dominant form of punishment throughout the free states. Nor were there those sentenced to confinement at hard labor restricted to digging ditches or other unskilled work. Nor were they only men. Prisoners were employed at an enormous range of tasks, from rope and wagon making to carpet, hat, and clothing manufacturing, where women prisoners were sometimes put to work, as well as coal mining, carpentry, barrel making, shoe production, house building, and even the manufacture of rifles. The range of petty and large workshops into which the felons were integrated made up the heart of the new American economy. Observing a free labor textile mill and a convict labor one on a visit to the United States, novelist Charles Dickens couldn't tell the difference. State governments used the rental revenue garnered from their prisoners to meet budget needs, while entrepreneurs made outside profits either by working the prisoners themselves or subleasing them to other businessmen. After the Civil War, the convict lease system metamorphosed. In the South, it became ubiquitous, one of the several grim methods, including the Black Codes, debt peonage, the crop lien system, lifetime labor contracts, and vigilante terror used to control and fix in place the newly emancipated slaves. Those free men were eager to pursue their new liberty either by setting up a small farm or by exercising the right to move out of the region at will or from job to job as free wage labor. And that was supposed to be what they were able to do. If you assumed, however, that the convict lease system was solely the brainchild of the apartheid all-white governments that overthrew the radical Republican regime, which first ran the defeated Confederacy during the Reconstruction, and used their power to introduce Jim Crow to Dixie, you'd be wrong again. In Georgia, for instance, the radical Republican state government took the initiative soon after the war ended. And this was because the convict lease system was tied to the modernizing sectors of the post-war economy, no matter where in Dixie it was introduced or by whom. So convicts were leased to coal mining, iron forging, steel making, and railroad companies, including Tennessee Coal and Iron, a major producer across the South, especially in the booming region around Birmingham, Alabama. More than a quarter of the coal coming out of Birmingham's pits was then mined by prisoners. By the turn of the century, the same company had been folded into J.P. Morgan's United States Steel Complex, which also relied heavily on prison laborers. All the main extractive industries of the South were, in fact, wedded to the system. Turpentine and lumber camps deep in the fetid swamps and forest vastness of Georgia, Florida, and Louisiana commonly worked their convicts until they dropped dead from overwork or disease. The region's plantations, monocultures, and cotton and sugar made regular use of imprisoned former slaves, including women. Among the leading families of Atlanta and Birmingham and other New South metropolises were businessmen whose fortunes originated in the dank coal pits, malaria marshes, isolated forts, and squalid barracks in which their unfree peons worked, lived, and died. Because it tended to grant absolute authority to private commercial interests, and because its racial makeup in the post-slavery era was overwhelmingly African-American, the South's convict lease system was distinctive. Its caste nature is not only impossible to forget, but should remind us of the unbalanced racial profile of America's bloated prison system today. Moreover, this totalitarian-style control invited appalling brutalities in response to any sign of resistance. Whippings, water torture, isolation in dark cells, dehydration, starvation, ice baths, shackling with metal spurs riveted to the feet, and what was called tricing, an excruciatingly painful process in which the prisoners were strung up by the thumbs with fishing line attached to overhead pulleys. Even women in a hosiery mill in Tennessee were flogged, hung by the wrist, and placed in solitary confinement. Living quarters for prisoner workers were usually rat-infested and disease-ridden. Work lasted at least from sunup to sundown and well past the point of exhaustion. Death came often enough, and bodies were cast off in unmarked graves by the side of the road or by incineration in coke ovens. Injury rates averaged one per worker per month, including respiratory failure, burnings, disfigurement, and loss of limbs. Prison mines were called nurseries of death. Among southern convict laborers, the mortality rate, not even including the high levels of suicide, was 800% that of similar workers in the north, and it was extraordinarily high there. The southern system also stood out for the intimate collusion among industrial, commercial, and agricultural enterprises in every level of southern law enforcement as well as the judicial system. Sheriffs, local justice of the peace, state police, judges, and state governments conspired to keep the convict lease business humming. Indeed, local law officers depended upon the leasing system for a substantial part of their income. They pocketed the fines and fees associated with convictions, a repayable sum that would be added on to the amount of time at hard labor demanded of the prisoners. The arrest cycle was synchronized with the business cycle, timed to the rise and fall of the demand for fresh labor. County and state treasuries similarly counted on such revenues, since the post-war South was so capital-starved that only renting out convicts assured that prisons could be built and maintained. There was, then, every incentive to concoct charges or send people to jail for the most trivial offenses: vagrancy, gambling, drinking, partying, hopping a freight car. A pig law in Mississippi assured you 5 years as a prison laborer if you sold a farm animal worth more than $10. Theft of a fence rail could result in the same. All this was only different in degree from prevailing practices everywhere else. The sale of prison labor power to private interests, corporate punishment, and the absence of all rights, including any civil liberties, the vote, and the right to protest or organize against terrible conditions. In the North, where 80% of all U.S. prison labor was employed after the Civil War, and which accounted for over $35 billion in output in current dollars, the system was reconfigured to meet the needs of modern industry and the pressures of the Long Depression. Convict labor was increasingly leased out only to a handful of major manufacturers in each state. These textile mills, oven makers, mining operations, hat and shoe factories, one in Wisconsin leased the state's entire population of convicted felons, were then installing the kind of mass production methods becoming standard in much of American industry. As organized markets for prison labor grew increasingly, the rest of the economy was spurred by it. The Depression of 1873 and subsequent depressions in the following decades wiped out many smaller businesses that had once gone trawling for convicts. Today, we talk about the newly flexible economy, often a euphemism for the geometric growth of a precariously positioned, insecure workforce. the convict labor system of the 19th century offered an original specimen of perfect flexibility. Companies leasing convicts enjoyed authority to dispose of their rented labor power as they saw fit. Workers were compelled to labor in total silence. Even hand gestures and eye contact were prohibited for the purpose of creating silent and insulated work machines. Supervision of prison labor was ostensibly shared by employers and the prison authorities. In fact, many businesses did continue to conduct their operations within prison walls, where they supplied the materials, power, and machinery, while the state provided guards, workshops, food and clothing, and what passed for medical care. As a matter of practice, though, the foreman of the business called the shots, and there were certain states, including Nebraska, Washington, and New Mexico, that, like their southern counterparts, ceded complete control to the lessee. As one observer put it, felons are mere machines held to labor by the dark cell and the scourge. Free market industrial capitalism then and now invariably draws on the aid of the state. In that system's formative phases, the state has regularly used its coercive powers of taxation, expropriation, and in this case, incarceration to free up natural and human resources lying outside the orbit of capitalism proper. In both the North and the South, the contracting out of convict labor was one way in which the state-assisted mechanism of capital accumulation arose. Contracts with the government assured employers that their labor force would be replenished any time a worker got sick, was disabled or died, or simply became too worn out to continue. And now we have the new abolitionism. Dependency and flexibility naturally assumed no resistance, and there was plenty of that all through the 19th century for workers, farmers, even prisoners. Indeed, a principal objective in using prison labor was to undermine efforts to unionize. But from the standpoint of mobilizing workers, it was far more at stake. And then it goes on from there. I think that gives you enough of an idea to let you know that the private prison system today exploits a million people, the people giving donations to Hillary Clinton, and Clinton is a major supporter of the private prison system. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. Walk home in my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now, I say a little prayer for you. Forever, forever, you'll stay in my heart, and I will love you forever and ever. We never will part. Oh, how I'll love you together, together. That's how it must be to live without you. It would only mean heartbreak for you.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I just wanted to make a quick announcement about our upcoming retreat in April. I just opened up one spot for April 17th through the 24th, and I have three spots left for the 24th through the 30th, shaping up to be one of the most exciting, life-changing retreats I think we've ever had.
I'm optimistic that we will have people, some people, who come with an idea that maybe it's an opportunity for them to be as healthy, as happy, and dynamic as they can be. You never know what someone's real motive are. It would be for them to come to a retreat. We provide a magnificent setting up near the Arkansas border in the beautiful mountains with lakes and trees that go 150 feet high, with workshops that start in the morning and go all day. A person can take as many as few as they want. Just to be able to go out on a country road and to power walk and see the beautiful pastures, bucolic scenes of horses and mares at this time of year, the little fold and the cattle and sheep. To be able to sit at a meal and realize that this is a real gourmet vegan treat, gluten-free, dairy-free. To have classes this year taught by my daughter Shelley on guilt-free desserts. how if you have a sweet tooth, how you can set aside that sweet tooth, but without sugars. To be able to exercise and have specialized exercise by John Q and have water aerobics in a deep mineral pool from the ancient mineral waters that have been there for millions of years. I do a lecture every night, anywhere from 2 to 3 hours. You're counseling throughout the day. We have Art is Healing, which is one of our most popular classes, meditation classes, sound and healing classes, all types of classes. And it's just a magnificent opportunity for people to give themselves a treat that they will not get. You will not get this by going to any resort in the world. And I've seen people transform their lives. We recently heard from a board-certified oncologist who came, who said that what she saw, what she personally experienced, she could not understand. There was nothing within her normal background of training and conditioning to let her know the power of energy, and yet she experienced it. What she does with it remains to be seen. But a lot of people have transformative experiences. So for the person that wants to come and join us, we welcome you. We keep it as small groups, so there's lots of time and attention for each person. So look forward to getting that person. Give the number out, please.
Surely, it's 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. I interview everyone to make sure it's the right venue for you, and I can tell you, Gary, we have some great people. We talk about being around like-minded people that want to really help themselves be the absolute best they can be. Maybe they're going through a transition in their life. We have many reasons why people are coming, but all of them are to move forward in their lives in a more positive way and gain the insight that they need to do that.
Also, it's going to be fun, but I have 5 new films that are going to be done by June. 3 of those films I'm going to be showing down there. They'll be the first people to see it, plus 2 new books I'll have down there. I won't have the book signings or be on sale until June, but I will have advanced copies, and these are powerful books. So it's going to be a wonderful time. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
For those of you who would like to listen to this radio program any day of the week at noon, call this number, Listen Live, 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. Here's a couple things to think about from our environmental segment from Jen Hayden, Daily Cause. Think your plastic is being recycled? Think again. This is short but important. Quote, think those plastic items you carefully separate from the rest of your trash are being responsibly recycled? Think again. U.S. recycling companies have largely stayed away from recycling plastic, and most of it has been shipped to China, where it can be processed cheaper. Not anymore. China announced a green fence policy prohibiting much of the plastic recycling they once imported. For many environmentally conscious Americans, that's a deep satisfaction that they're getting something recycled. Not anymore. From the shampoo bottles to butter tubs, the type of plastics in the plastic categories number 3 through 7, little do they know that even if their local trash collector says it's recycling that waste, they might as well be chucking that plastic into the trash bin. Plastics number category 3 through 7 are absolutely going to a landfill. China is not taking it anymore because of the green fence. David Kaplan, CEO of Maine Plastics, a post-industrial recycler, tells Quartz, quote, this will continue until we can do it in the United States economically. U.S. recyclers are scrambling to come up with a solution now that China is drastically cutting back on their top imports from the U.S. I also have an idea. I believe that we have the technology now using something similar to a whaling ship, where you can have the back end of the ship that can have a giant, or maybe a 50-yard wide gate that comes down and then bring in plastic from the Pacific, for example, where it is immediately processed and put into one of two things. A, you can burn it, melt it, and put it into pure tubes so that you can concentrate it. Therefore, it can be put into a proper recycling system, but gotten out of the Atlantic, and you can put proper filtration systems on so you don't pollute the air. And you just have these ships that are refueled and have a bunch of these ships from all countries of the world going all over. You could have 1,000 ships out there and picking up all the garbage. Now, how much garbage do we have? Enough that it would be 3 times the size of Texas. That's how much garbage. And it's killing sea life. That would be something that is practical and doable. And also, from the environmental segment from Climate News Network, quote, the speed at which the climate is changing is outstripping forests' ability to adapt to drier, hotter conditions across vast swaths of the United States and Canada. Drought and climate change are now threatening almost all the forests of the continental U.S. Scientists from 14 laboratories and institutions warn in the journal Global Change Biology that climate is changing faster than tree populations can adapt. Existing forests, effectively and literally rooted to the spot, are experiencing conditions hotter and less reliably rainy than those in which they had evolved. Over the last 2 decades, warming temperatures and variable precipitation have increased the severity of forest droughts across much of the continental U.S. And what that means is just trees are dying, 88 million alone. You have dieback bark beetle infestation and wildfire risks. They're all over these states. So the idea that, oh, you know, climate change moved to a better climate north, not true. You're going to end up with terrible situations up there as well. So that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening in today, and I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.